Welcome everyone to this interview where I'm super happy to be talking with Dr. Abdul Larkin. Firstly, Abdul, welcome. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you, Alex. Thank you for having me.
So in this interview, we're going to be exploring pain and the many dimensions of pain. I've been dipping into Abdul's book, The Anatomy of Pain. There's also a UK version, Pain, the Science of the Feeling Brain, and a softback version coming out, Pain, What It Is, Why It Happens, and How to Cope. I'd love to start a little bit though, Abdul, with your journey to working with pain. And you start in the book sharing a little bit of that. Love to hear that.
So I'm a medical doctor, and I was born and brought up in South Africa. And then I ran away from home in 2001. There was a woman involved. We won't go into that. I'm sure you'll listen. That's probably the subject for another book. And I came to the UK wanting to specialize in intensive care medicine, in critical care medicine. And in order to do that, you had to become an anaesthetist because critical care is a subspecialty of anaesthesia. You can't come at it from emergency medicine or general medicine, but I chose to come through anaesthetics. And then really during my training, I felt that critical care wasn't the sort of environment that I wanted to work in for a lot of reasons. I found, looking after people who were critically ill challenging from a psychological point of view. But I think what I missed was the contact with people, talking to them and being part of somebody's journey. And I actually, during my training, I got to, with the help of some really good clinicians, they exposed me to what life would be like as a consultant in that specialty. So as a trainee, it's, very different because you're observing from the outside, but then they said, oh, well, you run the unit today. And then suddenly you're confronted with the decision making and you're confronted with the politics and you're confronted with bed shortages. And I just thought, I'm not entirely sure if this is the career for me. There was something that was missing. And I thought about general practice and I contacted the, deanery who run the training program. And I said, well, I'm a bit disillusioned with all of these sleeping patients and pushing buttons. I'd like to do something perhaps where I could be more part of somebody's journey. And they told me what I needed to do, but serendipitously, I then did my module in pain medicine. So pain medicine is a subspecialty of anesthetics, and it's a strange place for pain medicine, but it's historical. Anesthetists are very good at sticking needles into people and injecting various substances. And originally we did that, for cancer pain, where we interrupted nervous system pathways in order to reduce pain and alleviate suffering. But as oncology got better, as pharmacological approaches improved, there was less need for those sorts of destructive procedures. And so we morphed into a specialty that looked at non-malignant pain, so non-cancer pain, so chronic back pain, which is about the most common pain you can find. And we still had our needles and we now had steroids and local anesthetic, and then we had electrical burning therapies. And so anesthetists sort of morphed into treating non-cancer pain. And I was sat in a pain clinic and listening to the consultant talk to the patient and explain their pain. And it was the fact that, one, it's a fascinating subject just from a physiological point of view, the mysteries of pain, how we study it at the moment, how we understand it historically in a very simple way when, Galen, the Roman physician, tied the nerves off of dogs and saw that the dogs couldn't move their body parts and then kind of realized that the brain was the center of sensation rather than, as the Greeks had believed, the heart. And then looking at how our progress in understanding of pain and how that translated into the treatments. And the fact that actually after thousands of years, we still only had opioids to try and dampen out down this alarm system. And we kind of still continue to use those because fundamentally a true understanding of the neurophysiology of pain still eludes us. So I sat in the clinic, but what I watched was somebody having pain explained to them. And having it explained to them that their spine was not crumbling, that the pain was due to a broken malfunctioning alarm system, that the pain they were feeling was real, but that it wasn't something catastrophic or dangerous. And just watching that visible relaxation of somebody, just watching that tension leave their body, purely through somebody engaging them in a conversation, you know, that winding down of that primitive amygdala brain and getting them to just understand and reframe what they were feeling, I thought was probably the most powerful thing I've ever seen in medicine. And, you know, in my experience as an anesthetist, I remember sitting with somebody who was not for theatre, had ruptured an aneurysm, and just providing some analgesia and a conversation, how that was fast more, you know, it was more soothing than anything I'd ever done. And so the combination of an interest in relieving acute pain associated with operations, and also the privilege really of engaging with somebody with a long-term chronic pain condition where the pain itself is a disease, I felt that that was something that I could really, it would be a lifelong journey, a lifelong challenge. Yes. And that's, I think, what, and so I abandoned my abandoning of anesthesia and fortunately, you know, and these are the sorts of things that happen to you in your life. It's sort of sliding doors where you, your life takes a completely different direction. And I think at the time as well, I was, you know, going through a difficult trauma in my life from a psychological, personal point of view. And the woman I'd run away with had gone back to South Africa, and I was kind of a bit stranded. And I think in those moments of reflection and change, perhaps you stop being so, you know, active in terms of wanting to do things for people and realize that people have their own agency. And really, you know, you who deem yourself a giver, you're really but a witness. And I think within that space, I found my calling.
One of the things that struck me in the opening section of the book was the fact that in the when you're dealing with particularly that crisis pain management, that you're meeting people in such an intense moment in their life where the sort of animalistic side that comes into us of just survival. And I remember on Christmas Eve, Christmas just gone, and I had this agonizing toothache on Christmas Eve, and I was desperately calling around all these emergency dentists. And the thought that I might not get to see someone to get this pain resolved for like 3 days, whatever it was going to be, was just all consuming. I mean, it must be very interesting that day after day, you're meeting people in that peak experience, not necessarily a positive experience for them, but that intense moment for them.
It is. And I always have to remind myself that I am a person and I'm a human being, and the expression of distress by another human being will have massive triggers within me. And I think a lot of doctors often are not aware that actually the way the individual is approaching them, the language they're using, the things that they're saying will move that doctor to perhaps engage in an intervention, an operation, which is probably not got the greatest chance of success, but actually the desperation of that patient is moving them to be Ava's a rescuer. The patient feels like a victim. And then when the intervention fails, the patient then persecutes the clinician, who then feels like a victim. And so the drama continues.
Yes. I was struck in your book actually about your self-care practices before you do your clinic, when you go and you get up early and you go and have a sauna, and sort of how you prepare your own mind and body to be in that role.
Yeah. And I, you know, it's not something I've always done. I think I've fallen prey to the overworking, you know, not looking after yourself, not eating properly, not exercising on a regular basis, and really not understanding my own drivers. And that does affect patient care. I think you cannot be an agent for somebody. You cannot be a witness to their suffering if you yourself are suffering. It makes you end up with all sorts of biases in terms of treatment. It makes you not able to really explore the full biological, psychological, and social impact of the condition. And therefore, the treatments you reach for are based on your own distress. They say there are four ways of getting somebody out of your clinic. Offer them an injection, offer them a procedure, offer them an intervention, or refer them to somebody else. And you see that in the health service all the time, where somebody who sees somebody has not had the language to explain to them, look, this is the condition you have. These are the limitations of what we can achieve with our current technology. This is your prognosis, and we are going to do this, that, or the other. You'll find there's a throwaway medication, and that's really how the opioid crisis has started and been perpetuated. It's this treating distress with drugs, because we don't have the language to treat distress with words.
Yeah. I want to come back to that, but you said something a little bit earlier, which I think is a really important foundation here, which is pain is produced in the brain, not in the body. Can you explain that? Because I think that's a really important foundation to this perspective.
Yeah, that's the essence of the book, Alex, that you've identified there. And that's the reason I wrote it, because most people believe that the pain they have will be proportional to the tissue damage. So the way we understand pain is that if you have an injury, and there are only really three ways you can injure the body: mechanically, chemically, and thermally. So, mechanically, you can be shot or stabbed or bump your toe, chemically with acid or an alkali, and thermally, either extremes of heat or cold. When the integrity of the body is damaged, so that outer aspect of us, that or inner aspect which protects us, is damaged, the brain needs to know about it. And the way that process works is that when you're injured, the body releases inflammatory mediators, so prostaglandins, bradykinins. There's a sort of whole chemical soup that gets released by the damaged tissue. The damaged, those prostaglandins and inflammatory mediators then attach to what are called nociceptors, and noci is the Greek god of mischief. So these are aptly named receptors, which again are massively complex, and there are people who spend years in labs studying the different kinds of nociceptors. And they then convert that mechanical, chemical, or thermal signal into an electrical signal. And that's transmitted first to the spinal cord, and then a bit like fireworks to the brain via various pathways. And the spinal cord is not passive, and the brain is not passive in receiving that information. So the brain receives the information, and there are motivational networks, salience networks. It goes to your amygdala, which is a sort of primitive emotional aspect of your brain. It goes to the bit of your brain that deals with location. There's a bit that checks in with, well, have I experienced this before? What do I know about it? And ultimately, you experience pain. And so, you can step in a drawing pin on a Sunday afternoon in your garden, and, you don't have anything to do, so it's a minor inconvenience. And if you're a sort of stoic person who has high self-efficacy and resilience, you'll be fine. But if you step in that same drawing pin whilst walking up to run the 100 meters in the Tokyo Olympics that you've been training for, 5 years for now, then that's a much bigger deal. So if you're a footballer and somebody touches you gently on the back of your leg, there's a lot of rolling around. But if you're a rugby player who gets tackled by somebody who weighs twice as much, you might just get up and shrug it off. So pain is not proportional to tissue injury. It has context. It's influenced by our pre-existing who we are. And in the context of trauma, that's really important. So we know that minor whiplash injuries in certain vulnerable individuals can produce long-term persistent pain and disability, whereas the same whiplash injury in an individual who is not vulnerable resolves after a few weeks. So really, the general public needs to understand that the pain they experience is an alarm. It's a useful alarm. It's not a brilliant alarm. For example, if you have appendicitis, you get this sort of non-specific pain. Pain from cancers can sometimes be quite late. The pain when you stub your toe is pretty immediate, or if you walk, over your child's Lego, that's a fairly, and depending on your disposition to your child at any one time, it's either going to be, oh, he left his Lego, or, other words that I probably shouldn't repeat. but we've all been there. So it's this primitive driver. Pain is like sleep or hunger. It grabs you. I mean, you describe your Christmas. I mean, you know, you're thinking in the back, you're not probably thinking, I won't get my turkey. I won't be able to eat all the deliciousness. But that is probably part of your distress.
Well, it's also in that instance, particularly, it's the thought that I might have to live with this for 3 days because I can't get a dentist till Monday. And it's also the funny thing, as someone that is quite good at putting off going to the dentist, I would have paid a very large amount of money for a dentist in that moment. So it also just it shifts your whole perspective on things.
Yeah, we're complicated creatures, and each of us is so different. I mean, it's the one thing that always strikes me when I'm in clinic is, you know, you meet somebody and you really see a segment of their world. You know, and you only really see a tiny bit. I have elderly parents, and you know, my sister's a psychologist, my brother's a GP, my father's a GP. So the whole family is medical. But whenever any of us is ill, we consult my mother, you know, who is a radiographer, because my mother is the sort of keeper of all wisdom and comfort.
Yeah.
So I always think behind every individual you see with a problem, there's a lot they're not telling you, and there's a whole family and cultural context behind it. And sometimes that can be a bit overwhelming. And so a lot of doctors shut that down, I think, because actually to start thinking about that and about the impact that you might have on a person and a family, I think that can be really quite overwhelming.
Well, one of the things that also struck me in the book is the impact that, and you've been touching on it here, that one's mood and one's mental and emotional state has on pain. For example, I was struck by, you said that those that are depressed tend to experience increased pain, that preoperative anxiety is a strong predictor of postoperative pain. I think people might be quite struck to hear that their mind and emotions are actually impacting their felt sense of physical pain.
Yeah, so we know from neuroscience that in the presence of anxiety and depression, there are pathways that go from your brain to your spinal cord that can inhibit or facilitate those signals that are being generated. And when you're depressed, you have lower chemicals that normally activate those pathways. So actually, the danger is always that people think, oh, it's psychological. And psychological always gets sort of dismissed and it's pejorative. There's a certain amount of judgment, I think, you know, of weakness that comes with that. But so I really try when I'm in clinic to very much boil everything down to chemicals and neurotransmitters. And I like to explain psychological challenges and behaviors in terms of neurochemical imbalances, because that's what they are. I mean, we don't have a Star Trek tricorder to scan for neurochemical imbalances yet, but there will probably come a time when you can have a brain scan at point of care, which can state, well, you're depressed because there is a, you know, serotonin and noradrenaline imbalance, and we can reset you. I think, unfortunately, where our technology lags behind, we tend to always, and we have done it historically, invoke spirits, voodoo, mythology, and, you know, mental health. But it's all chemistry. And I think we know now that pain pathways are complex, and that in the future, we may be able to understand these pathways so expertly that psychological therapies would be able to target exactly those pathways. So instead of just having a general CBT approach, if you can really understand the neurochemical imbalance, you might be able to offer somebody a talking therapy that specifically addresses their, you know, neurochemical disturbance. So, yeah.
I think something also implicit in what you're saying is that there's a lot more hope for those suffering, particularly with chronic pain, than they may realize. That, and maybe that's worth exploring briefly, that difference between acute pain and chronic pain, because I think sometimes people think, I have this pain is intense, this pain is not going away, therefore there must be damage and it's always going to be this way. And I think what's key in what you're saying is that the story is much more complicated than that. And actually, it is also, therefore, there's hope that shifting one's perspective, shifting one's response, shifting one's wider life, which we can also come to, can have a real impact.
Absolutely. So acute pain, we have this sort of fairly, I mean, it's a useful but somewhat artificial separation between acute and chronic. Acute pain is pain associated with tissue injury and usually resolves when the injury resolves. And, you know, that kind of takes maybe 3 months with most injuries. And then chronic pain is pain which persists beyond a period of around 3 months, which is an artificial period of time. But the crucial bit of the definition is that chronic pain is pain in the absence of ongoing tissue damage. And in the latest International Classification of Diseases version 11, the International Association for the Study of Pain, which is a good resource for people who want to know a bit more about pain, apart from my book, of course, they have decided to divide chronic pain into primary or secondary. So if I just go back again, acute pain, there's damage. You know, you break your bone, you have an operation, you have those inflammatory mediators. Over time, the wounds heal, the inflammatory mediators go away, and the system goes back to its default quiet setting. That's acute pain. It's what most of us know. But occasionally, despite all that healing, the alarm becomes dysfunctional. I always tell people it's a bit like a car alarm. Acute pain is somebody bashes into your car, the alarm goes off, you go out, you chase them away, you get the car fixed, and the alarm switches off. But sometime after that, or after that incident, now the alarm seems to go off whenever it wants to. You go outside, you keep checking the car, which is like having the repeated MRI scan and the repeated investigation and going to your doctor. And your doctor doesn't have the language to say, look, the car is okay. He might say, well, the tires are a bit frayed, and a causal relationship is made between the tire and the pain. But actually the problem is in the alarm. The wiring is now being permanently affected. And so the alarm goes off. And it hasn't got anything to do with your spark plugs or, you know, the frayed tires. But if you go to a spark plug specialist doctor, then they will replace the spark plugs because in their worldview, you know, those spark plugs, you're complaining of pain. They don't understand faulty wiring pain. And so they'll replace your spark plugs. And so there are loads of medical interventions which have that as their model. So acute pain, chronic pain is either primary or secondary. Secondary chronic pain is if there was an inciting event. So you had cancer, you got chemotherapy, the chemotherapy damaged your nerves, and now you've got nerve pain following chemotherapy. You have a car accident, you get a whiplash injury, and you develop sensitization, is the word we use for the broken alarm system. You develop central sensitization where the brain and spinal cord changes. And now, even though your neck is structurally stable, you have persistent pain. The primary chronic pain conditions are conditions like fibromyalgia, widespread pain. We're not sure what the cause is. It seems to happen in certain people. There's clearly a genetic component. Low back pain is a brain disease. Low back pain is not a back pain, is not a back disease. Low back pain is a widespread multi-system condition. But because the pain is complained of in the lower back and we have MRI scans and, you know, rods and screws, we've tried to treat this complex psychosocial brain condition with interventions that are costly and which make people more disabled.
And I think you spoke to it very well a bit earlier when you said that one of the things that tends to happen is people go and see a pain specialist and they're suffering and the practitioner wants to help and they have a limited set of choices that they can use. So people can then, one of the things that has obviously been a major issue in recent decades is people then become addicted to pain medication and they then can't function without it. Maybe speak a bit to some of the problems that can come from that.
Yeah, so the difficulty is really the way medicine is set up. And, you know, we treat complex conditions that we don't really know that much about. With medications, we know even less about. With people, we know nothing about. I think it was Voltaire who said something like that. But, you know, we're trained, there's what's called the biomedical approach, and the biomedical approach seeks to find a diagnosis and then treat it. You know, the biomedical diagnosis is the deviation from the norm according to that doctor. The biopsychosocial approach aims to look at the whole individual, understanding that psychological and social factors will impact on disease. So, you know, even if you look at something like diabetes, sure, diabetes from a biological point of view is a relative or absolute lack of insulin. Fair enough, we can treat that with medication. The difficulty is if you don't address the person's understanding of their diabetes, their social context, societal values around sugar and fast food, etc., then it doesn't matter how great your insulin is or your metformin, you're not really going to ensure a good outcome for that patient. And pain medicine is no different. If you treat it only biomedically, then you will try injections or interventions or medication. The difficulty is that we don't fully understand the neurophysiology or the pathophysiology of chronic pain. I mean, we've got a fairly good idea about diabetes. You know, it's a relatively straightforward condition in comparison. So you're then doomed to failure because you're treating a condition where we don't have treatments that are 100% effective. If the pain then doesn't go away, the person is left to think whatever they can, whatever they want in terms of, well, it's not going away. It must be serious. So their distress escalates. As their distress escalates, your intervention escalates, or your opioid prescribing escalates. Then in a vulnerable population, you might develop addiction. People are biologically vulnerable to addiction, which is continued use of the opioid despite it causing psychological distress. But even if you don't become addicted, you know, you become dependent. And there are opponent processes. There's the opponent process theory of opioids where, you know, the A processes are the euphoria, but the B opponent processes are the dysphoria, the negative. The opioids change your brain. I think what people think is don't realize is that opioids actually change the neurochemistry of your brain, and therefore coming off them can be very difficult. And you know, it's the affective component of pain that opioids address. So there's a reason why people use opioids as drugs of abuse, because if you are very anxious about the world, what opioids do is they kind of throw a big blanket over you. Now, you might feel a little less distressed, but nobody can operate under a blanket. And if you take highly distressed chronic pain patients who have already got a deranged cognitive framework, you throw that blanket over them. They then can't access those psychological and social changes within their lives that would enable them to manage their pain better. So you're almost handicapping them in terms of their ability to manage their condition. And we know a lot. There's a lot of basic science. There's a lot of people who I recently attended the IASP's World Congress, and there are loads of people doing really interesting work on, you know, MRI scanning of people with Tabasco sauce in their mouth and seeing, you know, which bits of the brain light up. There are people who are looking at animal models of pain and how, you know, pain changes your genetics. But I sat there thinking, this is really quite interesting, but it doesn't really help me as a clinician at the coalface.
Right.
So I think patients need to have we need to have an honest conversation about patients, about the nature of their condition. Unfortunately, when you have a hammer, everything will eventually look like a nail, especially if the hammer is sponsored by, you know, a particular company.
Yeah. Well, it also strikes me as you're speaking that there's something around people's expectations of physicians and practitioners and their responsibility in their own healing path, that I think it can be very easy to go and see a practitioner and think, I need you to give me a drug. Your job is to know which drug to give me, and that's going to fix me, as opposed to becoming proactive in one's own healing process.
Yeah, no, yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, the medical profession does sell that model because obviously it's in our interest to do so. But active participation in prevention. I mean, as I get older, you know, I spend more time in the gym now because I look at my parents and I think, you know, genetically they're pretty robust, but what they're struggling with is the musculoskeletal problems associated with not having had an active lifestyle. And, you know, I always say to the patients, I said, you know, when you're a young car, you can, you know, take the car out all hours of the day. You can do donuts in the parking lot. You can get it. But when you're a vintage car, really, you don't do less maintenance on the car. You have to do more. Vintage cars require more maintenance. You know, you need to take them out. You need to run them through. You need to do all of those things. But we have this weird thing where we get to a certain age and we kind of retire from exercise. We go, well, you know, we've done enough in our lives. And we don't look after our mental health, and we chase, you know, the last part of the book is very much my reflection really on what I see. And I'm probably straying on the expertise of, you know, many of the experts that I've looked at on your website for the trauma conference, you know, looking at maintenance of mental health, looking at nutrition, looking at what we know the things that aren't good for us. You know, there's so much information out there now. I was saying to my wife Nicola this morning, you know, I listen to all sorts of podcasts about all sorts of things, you know, and I read fairly widely on, you know, I'm reading Daniel Kahneman's book Noise at the moment, and just you get this wow moment where you think, I thought I knew what I was thinking. Then you read the perspective of somebody else and you go, I don't really know anything about that. It's a bit like Socrates said, the only thing I know is that I don't know.
Yeah.
And so increasingly...
happens when you do my job. You realize how little you know when you go in thinking you know a lot about something.
The other day, my mother said to me, she said, I had this patient and we talked about, you know, their diet. And my mother said, sorry, are you a dietitian or are you a pain specialist? And I said, look, I've got a person in front of me and I can't just say to them that, you know, narrowly will treat your pain problem, but actually all of those other things in your life, all those other activities are negatively affecting you as a whole person. And I think that's where the medical profession is falling down, is that we're the tip of the spear, but for chronic long-term conditions, we shouldn't be, you know, and it shouldn't be a spear, because a spear implies that there's a cure. You know, we need to be educating people that looking after your physical body and looking after your mental health is a lifelong journey. And, you know, more of that should be taught in schools. And if we did that, we would be able to prevent some of these diseases of lifestyle rather than kind of trying to patch people up when they're already broken.
And I think it's great that there is growing evidence around what you mentioned as the biopsychosocial model of health. But I think it still needs to move into actually the practical day-to-day recommendations. That it's like, it strikes me that increasingly physicians and practitioners are aware of the importance of these different ingredients. But actually, when it comes down to when the rubber meets the road, what does that actually mean in terms of practical changes? And I'm curious as to, as that's unfolding and evolving in your own clinical work, someone comes to you and you recognize, you're able to have this dialogue and they're engaging. What would be some of the really practical things that you would have them start to focus on?
So I'm fortunate, I've kind of self-selected to work in a pain management unit that has 5 psychologists and 6 physiotherapists. And, you know, we try to be evidence-based in terms of the treatments we offer. And it depends on the chronic pain condition. But say, for example, with musculoskeletal low back pain, the first is pain neuroscience education. So a bit of like the conversation we've had today, to try and demystify chronic pain, to make them understand, or to try and help the individual understand that pain is not due to ongoing tissue damage, to try and dial down that sort of, you know, heightened and stressed amygdala. Now, that's met with variable success, because some patients, they don't want to hear that they have to manage this problem. They want a cure. So often that's a challenge. But that's where you start. Explaining pain is the place to start. And we, you know, there are loads of online resources, and we've produced our own leaflets and I've written that book, really trying to explain pain. Once you've done that and they now understand and the patient starts to understand and accept that the pain that they're experiencing, the abnormal sensations, that that's not, you know, catastrophic, then begins the process of learning better ways to manage. So for example, you know, people have good days and bad days with their pain. And so on a good day, they'll try and catch up with all the things that they've not done. So we teach pacing, you know, pacing your activities. We teach problem solving. So how to reframe a task if it's something that is affected by pain. We teach people how to re-engage with their families to try and explain to their families, you know, what the condition is. And it's our psychologists and physiotherapists who are really the rock stars of behavioral change. But behavioral change is very, very difficult. You know, if you've ever tried to change a habit of yours, then you can imagine, you know, it's difficult. And if you're beset with pain, which is trying to sort of grab your attention, I always say to the patients, it must be when you have chronic pain, like living with a particularly annoying child who's always tugging at you while you're trying to accomplish your day-to-day tasks. And patients kind of go, yeah, that is pretty much what it's like. You know, sometimes you can ignore the child and sometimes you can, you know, sometimes you can't. But what you're really trying to do is to put boundaries around that child, to try and get that child to behave better. It's not going away, but you can change how you respond and you can change the choices you make. And it's not easy. And, you know, people will continue to fluctuate throughout their lives. But from a doctor point of view, I don't have a lot to offer. You know, there are a few interventions that have good evidence, spinal cord stimulation for nerve pain. You know, there's limited utility with medications, and increasingly we're realizing the harms we cause with drugs like gabapentin. Certainly the opioids, in my view, I struggle to see a place, and in the latest is cannabis, and we seem to be going down the same route with cannabis. You know, where really, if you're going to offer somebody a treatment, it really needs to have been evaluated in a very robust way. So you can have an honest conversation about what are the risks, what are the benefits, what are the long-term consequences. This is the population we've studied in it. You match or do not match that population. And I think that's the way really to proceed. But as you said with your toothache at the beginning, when somebody's desperate, it is very easy to end up offering them something which you almost convince yourself is going to help, just so you can quell your own distress that you feel when encountering something like that.
And I think it will be very helpful, though, for people to hear you speak of it in that way, because I think sometimes when people go and see a practitioner in a lot of pain and not feeling like they're given the magic bullet, they can sometimes feel that that practitioner is not caring or doesn't understand because they're not fixing it. And yeah. I think it's helpful for people to hear that actually that interaction is a relationship between two people. And it's also hard for the practitioner that unless they are a sociopath, actually wants to end the suffering of the person in front of them. They just haven't got perfect choices available.
And communication, as we know, between people is fraught with difficulty. You know, what I'm saying to you and what people are listening to, I increasingly realize when patients come back to my clinic and I say to them, okay, well, we spoke the last time, what do you remember? And it amazes me sometimes at the miscommunication. I think, you know, in my own life, what I've increasingly tried to do is to go and understand things myself. You know, if there's something I don't understand, there is a podcast or a YouTube video these days which will give you the beginnings of information. I think one of the reasons I wrote the book is really, and it's an extended reflection on my own attitude to life, is look, if you don't understand something, you can't always rely on another imperfect human to understand it. But there is the wisdom of crowds. So if you listen to 10 imperfect humans, somewhere there you might find truths that are repeating themselves. And I think you also have to, as a person, take responsibility for the choices that you make. You know, so it's a so I think at the end of the day, if you don't understand, then you need to go and find out. And also you need to understand that, and I think everybody's become during the pandemic a sort of mini statistician and a probability theorist and a, you know, risk. But that is what we need to be teaching in schools. We need to be teaching not calculus, which, you know, I have this recurring nightmare where I wake up and I think I have to sit my calculus exam. I know as much calculus as I do now. And then I wake up and go, oh, no, you're not 18 anymore. But I've never used that. But actually, odds ratios, probability, risk benefit, those are the sorts of, you know, how to assess evidence. Those are the skills which I think people lack. And so, you know, if you, we tend to believe, and there's also seems to be a sort of short attention span we have these days. Nobody seems to read anymore. We rely on kind of, you know, rapidly scrolling through various social media sites as the source of our information. And what I would say to people who have chronic pain and who are listening to this is that there's a commitment required if you have any chronic long-term condition to becoming the expert. I always say to people who attend our pain management programs, which are CBT or cognitive behavior therapy based programs, is and I do the doctor session and I talk about doctors and I talk about how doctors are trained and how they interact with patients. But I say to them, look, your doctor is not necessarily the doyen of all information, and really you need to become the expert. And you can, you know, there is so much, as I've said before, information available that you can educate yourself to a really high degree nowadays just with a Wi-Fi connection.
And of course, pain used in the right way can also be a powerful motivator, right? I think when people move out of that initial shock and panic that I've just got to find a way to end this, if one can start to learn to live with it and find a softer relationship, it can also be, you know, sometimes the motivation people to make big changes in their lives is it's simply too painful not to. So there's also the potential for the pain to be used in the right way.
Yeah, pain is can be your baptism, I think somebody once said. And yeah, I mean, if you look, I always get patients, I try to get patients to reflect on, you know, rugby players, for example, who bash into each other for 80 minutes and who never stop. And you think, and I say to them, you know, each of those interactions has been recorded as being the equivalent of a car crash.
Is that right?
Yeah, those are the forces. I mean, those guys are big. And but they endure, you know, they get up and they continue. I said, if you and I did that, it wouldn't be within the context of what we normally experience, but you can become habituated to pain. It's not to dismiss or minimize what people feel, but it's really to empower them to become active participants in the management of their own lives and their conditions.
Yeah, what I take from this, Abdul, is it's a message of hope ultimately, but it may not be what people first hear because they want to hear the miracle solution.
It requires work. I always say to the patients, this requires work. I often say, you know, if you want to lose weight, yep, you can go to Weight Watchers. That's like coming to see me today, and I can give you a plan. I can educate you about food, but I cannot be in control of what you do when you go home, you know. And the same, and so there is hope, but it does require work. Like everything, unfortunately, that is worth achieving in life.
Yeah. Abdul, I think this has been fascinating. I really want to encourage people to get your book. I think it's a great starting point for people. And also, it's readable. So often books on subjects like this can be a little intimidating. And I found myself ripping through the chapters and really enjoying it. Just for people to help them find it, they can go to Amazon or wherever sell books. And in the US, it's The Anatomy of Pain. In the UK, the hardback version is Pain, the Science of the Feeling Brain. And Abdul was just telling me before we started recording, there's a paperback version coming out in the UK, Pain, What It Is, Why It Happens, and How to Cope. But I think the simplest thing is to put Abdul's name into any of the book websites and you'll find the book. I really recommend it. I think it's a great way to go deeper on this interview, but also to get empowered, which I think is ultimately the message. So, Abdul, thank you so much for your time today. I really
Thank
appreciate it.
you.